Good afternoon and good evening and hi guys. It's really, really as always very beautiful to be here with you, and especially beautiful because today we're moving into the heart, the Hrit Chakra, that's Sanskrit for heart, or also known as the Hridaya, also known as the Anahata, which means the unstruck sound, as many of you know. And as I've been contemplating this evening's conversation, I looked into a book that I have found to be probably the best kind of scholarly work in English on the chakras. It's called Laya Yoga, The Definitive Guide to the Chakras and Kundalini by someone named Shyam Sundar Goswami. It's a, I think it was originally in Bengali, or it's by a Bengali writer, and it's got the different tantric textual explications about the chakras. And one of the things you see, which is somewhat frustrating to a Westerner with a linear mind, which is to say most of us, is that you realize that all the different tantras have somewhat different descriptions of the chakras. And this is especially true of the Hridaya, of the heart chakra, the Anahata. In fact, the writer of this text is not exactly sure when he looks at the different scriptures that speak about it, whether the heart chakra is the Anahata or whether it's another chakra called the Hrit chakra that's said to be right underneath the heart, just above the Manipura. And I'm going to speak about it with reference to several texts, but mostly with reference to my own experience, my own years of practice. And I think that we'll find that what we're talking about here is pretty much in line with the way we experience this center. So let's find ourselves a comfortable posture. And some of you may find it helpful to have the painting of the fourth chakra from the website in front of you, but totally not necessary. And you can just begin by focusing on the breath and feeling the contact between the base of your body, the base of your posture, and your seat. Feeling how with the inhalation, the energy actually can be felt rising up through the center of the body, through the central channel, for today into the heart. And for those of you who are, as some of us are, not exactly sure where the heart center is, one of the ways I like to measure it is by putting the ring finger of my right hand right underneath that U-shaped bone at the collar, and then measuring two fingers from that, so six fingers below that U-shaped bone. And then, you know, find that place on the outside of your body. And then just imagine your attention going right behind that part of the breastbone into the very center of the body, even right into the area just in front of the spinal column. And as you do this, begin to allow the breath to create a kind of subtle wind that starts to bring your attention into the space of the heart, the cave of the heart, the energy of the heart. And just be aware how the energy, how the space, the energy space inside the heart, in this region of your body, how it feels right now. And please remember, there is no quote, correct way for the energy of the heart to feel. When we enter the heart, we are actually entering into the possibility of being really with what is, which sometimes feels very soft, comfortable, sometimes kind of fiery and prickly. I must admit, I've been having a kind of a fiery, prickly day. And I've been noticing the weather in my neighborhood is also kind of fiery and prickly. There's a huge windstorm that has temporarily come to a lull. So just feeling the inner weather and the outer weather, which I know is different for every one of you. And in this meditation, just let the breath, which is the subtle prana, which is, let's say, the breath inside the breath, let it flow in and out through the heart center like a subtle caress, almost as though this breath has energetic fingers that are massaging the inside of the heart. Kundalini Shakti in the heart center takes the form of a goddess, so it says. In fact, Kundalini in the heart center, we'll be speaking more about her as we continue, but have the feeling that Kundalini in the heart is rising, ready to reveal herself in many surprising forms as the inner light of the soul, which is one of the ways the texts and skillful meditators speak about the heart center, as the inner beloved, again, as the mystics especially describe the space of the heart, as the cave of the heart, or as a goddess. And before we do our mantras, I'd like to read you a poem which a beautiful woman named Dorothy Walters, who writes Kundalini-inspired poetry. This is a poem she sent me after a class like this one, because It so describes the experience of opening to the breath. She says, let the breath come in. And if a goddess too makes this her subtle path, do not deny her entry. He wishes to build transparent monuments in your heart, chambers whose quiet bells will resonate into your farthest reaches, your souls, your lids, your elbows even. For the God does not disdain even the humblest part, the clumsiest joining. This is his sly jest, his coy affirmation of you as oneness. Do not fear the God. As the wind wafts through light, she wafts through you. Ruach, prana, chi, lifting bone, cell, and tissue into that other world. Even in this one, trees bend to her in their slow spirals. Dolphins breathe her. Herons glide to her fluid rhythms. Do not fear the God. She is yourself returning. So with that feeling that each breath is a visitation from God, Goddess, Dorothy changes up her pronouns because we never know if this is a feminine force or a masculine force. What we know is that it is life force. And with that thought, with that understanding, we will begin to sing our meditative hymn, our beautiful hymn to Goddess Kundalini, the Kundalini Dhyana Mantra. Dhyayet Kundalinim Devim Swayambhulinga Veshtinim Shyamam Sukshmam Srishti Rupam Srishti Stiti Layatmikam Vyatitam Jnana Rupam Chintayet Urvavahinim Dhyayet Kundalinim Devim Swayambhulinga Veshtinim. Let us contemplate the upward flowing Kundalini Devi, the goddess coiled around the self-born lingam, the pillar-shaped form of Shiva, the goddess who is nectarian, who is subtle, who is the embodiment of creation, who is the creator, sustainer, and absorber of the universe, and who also transcends the universe, and who is wisdom herself. So with the inhalation, see if you can feel the energies of the breath flowing into the center behind the chest, behind the breastbone. And for this moment, we're imagining the breath flowing in horizontally. Not so much vertically, although if it's happening for you vertically, that's fine. But we're really letting the breath, which is in its own way the deity of the heart chakra, flow in, and with the inhalation feel the breath flowing into the center with, now with the mantra, Om Aim Hrim Shrim. Feeling, and this is to me the one of the big clues to allowing the mantra to take root in your subtle being. Allowing yourself to feel the mantra as an energy, as a vibratory, energetic, felt sense, almost a sensation that mingles with the breath and drops into the heart. See if you can allow the exhalation to deepen your sense of immersion in the center behind the breastbone. See if you can let the breath and the mantra begin to flow into your heart. Open and soften it if that's what your heart wants to do. Or simply bring your awareness deeper and deeper into the energetic sense of that center. The form of the heart chakra, the anahata, is of a 12-petaled flower, a lotus, with deep red petals. Within it is a six-pointed star, a Star of Solomon, which consists of two triangles placed on top of each other. And I have to say I find it extraordinarily significant that the Star of Solomon, which is, of course, the sort of major Jewish emblem, is also the geometrical form that is found in the heart center. And again, as many of you know, in tantric esoterica, it represents the coming together of the upper chakras with the lower chakras, or as they say in Hebrew wisdom, the upper waters with the lower waters, of Shiva with Shakti, of masculine ascending force with feminine descending embodying force. The rays of the star flow in all six directions, indicating the balance of energies in the heart, the balance of elements in the heart. And in the very center of the star, see if you can sense the presence of the flame of the heart, which is said to be the size of a thumb, said to be golden. I've seen it like this, actually, in meditation on occasion. And I know that many of you have also. In several of the Upanishads, the sacred books of Vedic India, of ancient India, it's said that in the heart is the city of Brahman, the city of the Absolute. And within that city, in the cave of the heart, God lives in the form of a thumb-sized flame, which is also known as the flame of the Atman, the individual self. And in the tantric traditions from which the chakras come, that flame is known as a lingam. That is a Shiva lingam. It's white gold. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna calls it the flame that has no smoke, the flame that burns steadily like a lamp in a windless place. So this is really the sacred flame, the flame of the heart, inside the six-pointed star. And as the breath flows in and out, feel that the breath is an offering into the flame of the heart. And you can allow the mantra Om Aim Hrim Shrim to be poured with the breath like an offering into the sacred flame in the heart. Somehow it's that feeling of reciting mantra and invoking breath as offering, that more than any other practice I know, certainly in my personal experience, begins to allow the heart cave to start to open and reveal herself to us. And remember that as thoughts arise, which inevitably they will, feel that every thought, whether it's a beautiful one, a distracting one, a mundane one, a spiritual one, recognize that every thought is an expression of Shakti, an expression of Goddess, manifesting even as your most mundane, distracting or disturbing thoughts. And as you become aware of thought, offer that too into the flame of the heart. as the breath flows as an offering into the heart flame with the mantra Om Aim Hrim Shrim. You may begin to feel your awareness going inward. You may begin to feel the heart expanding. As always, the conversation on the listserv has been really interesting this week, especially when people are speaking about the stuff that's arising as Kundalini brings up stored karmas. And one of the things that I've been saying on the listserv, for those of you who aren't listserv mavens, and also because I really want to bring it home to you, and the only way I know how to do this is through repetition, and that is that the process of opening ourselves to the work of Kundalini is also the process of recognizing that she is totally behind any practice that we do and any opportunity we take to be present with difficult feelings or, you know, from another point of view, to work with, for example, a creative problem. I've found that Kundalini has been the greatest friend to my own writing, to my own creative imagination, and I know that's true for many of you. But she's also the friend of your inner psychodynamic work. In fact, of anything that you may find yourself drawn to doing that will allow you to witness, be present with, and begin to, let's say, let go of your beliefs and your identifications with the concepts and thoughts that for each one of us create the unique inner world that we all live in, as well as the shared world that so many of us experience as apparent reality. And to notice how when Kundalini is really working deeply in us, so many things become the occasions for us to notice our triggers and to be present with the feelings that get triggered, you know, sometimes by something as simple as a story in the newspaper or, of course, a conversation with a friend or a child. This is an incredibly important aspect of our inner work. And the flame of the heart, which is really one of the points of entrance in the subtle body into the witness awareness, into the essence itself, into the, you know, what's often called the true self or the Atman in Sanskrit. So as we begin to do this, as we begin to be able to hold and witness the various forms of suffering that arise in the natural course of everybody's life and to stop believing that the suffering that we experience is unique to us, to begin to realize that whether it's family-based suffering, whether it's socially-based suffering, or any of the other stories that we tell ourselves, the existential suffering that most human beings experience is by and large the result of believing the stories that we tell ourselves about reality. And as I say this, it's not meant to deny the very real suffering of illness or social injustice, but simply to point out that we are beginning to have the opportunity to be free of the suffering that we cause ourselves through believing in what the mind tells us. So even though it's so important to each of us to become our best self, to be more loving, more skillful, at the same time, it's so important to realize that every part of us is no less divine than any other part of us. So your busy mind, even though it may be painful, is just as divine as your quiet mind, and your happy, awake self is no more divine than your messed up, suffering self. It's a really hard thing to get, but aside from being one of the great teachings of mysticism, it's also one of the freeing gifts that Kundalini wants to show us as the process evolves. There's a beautiful poem of Rumi's, which in his exquisite way speaks about this strange paradox that each of us is both the actor in our life, that is, the doer in our life, while at the same time, everything is being done by the divine, by the Shakti. He says, one hand shakes with palsy, another shakes because you slapped it away. One hand shakes with palsy, another shakes because you slapped it away. Both tremblings come from God. But you feel guilty for the one, and what about the other? These are intellectual questions. The spirit approaches the matter differently, Rumi says. We act freely and are yet fully a part of the divine unfolding. So as Shakti, as Kundalini moves from the third chakra into the fourth chakra, into that complex of centers in this region, as you start entering this part of the body, one of the main issues that comes up and that we are asked to deal with, and this is true not only for us as individuals, but really pretty much for the whole planet right now, is this internal demand that we look at our feelings of victimization and betrayal. The move from third chakra to fourth chakra, which is not linear, as we've said, but which is a huge kind of watershed in our spiritual journey. The move from third chakra to fourth chakra puts us right up face to face with our issues about betrayal, about power and powerlessness, about the dichotomy that some people call victim-tyrant. And it's a really big deal because there's not one of us who hasn't been betrayed and, of course, been the betrayer over and over again, just in this life, over and over again. And if you believe in reincarnation, in so many lives, we've played those roles. And this feeling of betrayal and anger about betrayal is actually one of the blocks that keeps us from moving out of, let's say, the bedrock belief in that we are the actors, that we are the doers, which is in classical chakra theory is, you know, more or less lodged in the third chakra or in the second and third chakra, to let us move past this feeling of being doers and victims, et cetera, et cetera, we have to look at the feeling of betrayal. And for me and for so many people, a lot of the physical residue of that issue of victim, betrayal, you know, and all of its manifestations is held in the diaphragm. We touched on the diaphragm at the end of the class last week, and I want to, just at this moment, as we begin to talk about this, to ask you to bring your attention to the diaphragm, which is kind of like a drum that's connected to the bottom of the rib cage, and for many of us, it's very hard to feel the diaphragm because, you know, we've been out of touch with that part of our body. But when you do begin to let yourself experience the diaphragm, remembering that it moves downward with the inhalation and moves upward with the exhalation, kind of like a membrane. And I'm just going to ask you to try a moment of diaphragmatic breathing. And the clue in diaphragmatic breathing, the thing that really shifted my breathing, was to begin to realize that diaphragmatic breathing is not, it's not so much about asking the breath to move down as it is about opening your rib cage, in other words, allowing your rib cage to expand to the side. And it's that form of breathing which actually lets the diaphragm get involved in your conscious act of breathing, which starts to allow us to kind of release some of the holding in the diaphragm. And another thing that helps, which I invite some of you to do, is to gently massage this part of your body. Again, very gently. There's a lot of stuff here. But just begin to move your hand over this area that stretches across your central body, just kind of below the rib cage, and which for many of us is fairly tight, and just feel it to the side, on the right side and the left side, very, very gently. So, in so many different situations, in different relationships, probably starting in early childhood, we have implicit memories of not being able to trust the people who are supposed to take care of us. And this happens even to people who have really good caregivers and really good upbringings. And it's a big part of what we have to work through. And as human beings learning how to live on earth, and which means learning how to forgive, to forgive the betrayals that are the natural part of our existence on this earth plane, because the experience of betrayal is inevitable. And one of the things that comes up as the Shakti starts to move up and open up the connections between the third chakra and the fourth chakra is memories and feelings that are connected to betrayal, which could manifest as anger, or to despair or hopelessness, or just feeling basically powerless. And if you look carefully into these feelings, you will often find that they are related to the sense of being a victim, of being victimized by life, to the unfairness of life, the injustice of life, and the feeling that people have done things to you. God has done things to you. You've been a victim. You've been betrayed. You felt powerless. You felt contracted. I know for me, you know, and when I've done work on looking at what the sort of core myths of my individual life in this incarnation happen to be, one of the ones that really resonates with me is the feeling of being misunderstood. You know, people think I'm a certain way, or people think I've done something, but actually I'm innocent, or, you know, actually I'm so much cooler than they think I am, or, you know, I'm not like they think I am. And I think that many of you know exactly what I'm talking about. My gurus used to specialize in calling us out on things that we actually hadn't done. And somehow I came to realize that, you know, when my teacher yelled at me for something that I knew damn well I hadn't done, that what was actually doing is triggering that feeling of betrayal, of being misunderstood, which is one of the core refuges of the false self-ego. I think I've said this before in this class, that when, you know, you're accused of something, that voice that comes up and says, I didn't do it, or it wasn't like that, is actually the voice of the betrayed one, of the victimized one. So, you know, it might, the feeling of betrayal might have arisen from something as primal as being a baby crying and for some reason nobody picks you up. Or maybe it's, you know, maybe it just happens once or twice in your life, or maybe you've been left alone to cry for hours and hours. But all of us have it. All of us have experienced that. All of us have had another kid take our toy or been bullied or loving somebody who didn't love us back, or worked hard and been denied the reward. There's so many situations, especially in early life, when we want something or we need something and it's denied. And of course, many of us have been part or are part of social groups in which there's collective betrayal. So these feelings, whether they're personal or collective or from this life or other incarnations, get held in the subtle body, and physically they're very often held in the diaphragm. It's very helpful to do this little massage, diaphragmatic massage and diaphragmatic breathing. When you're feeling, you know, in the kind of intense emotional relationship to the power-powerlessness dynamic. So we're faced, as the heart starts to open, with a way to let go, finding a way to let go of our grievances and our feelings of betrayal on the many, many levels in which they will come up for us, whether it's about people in general, certain people, and also to the nature of the world and the nature of the higher power. So, you know, as we mature, especially if we do serious psychodynamic work, we may have to, you know, do a kind of double-jointed thing of really getting what our parents, how our parents, you know, or caregivers may have failed us, seeing it, recognizing it, feeling it. This is really important. And then forgiving them. You know, forgiving all the people who didn't love you enough or who didn't see your beauty. Forgiving the people who betrayed your trust. There's so many for all of us. And for most of us, there are one or two incidents or experiences which are kind of like linchpins for the whole process of freeing ourselves from victim consciousness. And then, of course, there's the very deep issue of our feeling of betrayal by the divine. I know for me, the experience of anger at God, of anger at the way reality is, at, you know, why there's so much suffering and cruelty in the world, has been something that I've periodically, and I'm sure that's true of you, had to revisit again and again. And it's all about the opening of the heart. You know, and it's very much material that comes up as Kundalini is working in the heart. I've had some visions and dreams about this over the years, and one of them was a very strong dream vision of being in a church in a, you know, a kind of a Gothic church in London. Or somewhere in Northern Europe, being a child and being very poor, going into the church, calling out to God, how could you have done this to me? I'm never going to believe in you again. And what I got as I analyzed that dream, or as I tuned into that dream, was that somehow my family had died in an epidemic or in some way been taken away from me. I was alone, and I just could not understand how God could let something like this happen. You know, we've all had some level of this experience. And many of us, there's a lot of history of this kind of thing. Even just looking around at the world can give us a feeling of betrayal. So learning to forgive without turning our eyes away from, you know, the genuine horrors of life is a really big deal. It's one of the reasons why the Course in Miracles is all about forgiving as a pathway to enlightenment, and it is very much part of what we're asked to do as Shakti is moving into the heart. Some people believe these days that the planetary shift that's going on is actually the movement of consciousness from the third chakra to the heart chakra. I don't know whether that's true, but there certainly is a lot going on in this world that we need to feel into and find out how to hold and find a way to be in forgiveness with. One of the ways that psychologists who work with forgiveness have spoken about this process, they say that for many people, the idea of forgiveness is difficult, but what's somewhat easier for many people is letting go. I find my own experience is that as a human being, it's not that easy to forgive certain aspects of reality. But this is part of what Kundalini can do for us, can help us really learn what it is to let go of feeling betrayed. And I'm going to give you a homework practice this week because I don't want to do it in the class. It's something that we need to do with time to actually sit with it. It's a process for working with forgiveness and not wanting to forgive, because that's, of course, a big part of what keeps us from forgiving. We don't want to forgive. And to ask ourselves, you know, to hold this issue deeply in contemplation, to ask ourselves, why should I forgive? What keeps me from forgiving? What do I think should happen before I forgive? And why should I forgive? And, you know, asking these questions will bring up a lot of the objections and obstructions you have, the reasons why you don't want to forgive and let go of hurt. It's one I've worked with a lot and have found it very effective, because little by little it will start to show you in a deep way, not simply the intellectual understanding or the feeling that forgiveness is a good thing, but it'll actually help you open to the goddess of forgiveness. You know, forgiveness is a form of goddess and is also a form of the energy that lives in the heart. So, deep breath now, letting the rib cage expand, feeling now the energy in the center of the heart, the presence of the six-pointed star radiating in all directions, sensing the presence of the flame in the heart, and again becoming aware of the energy in this center, peaceful or restless or emotional or numb. Just be present to it. And for some of you, this tuning into the heart may bring you in a kind of radical touch with what's called the knot of the heart, which we sometimes experience as really like a knot, you know, like, oh my God, my heart feels so blocked. So as you feel the breath caressing the heart, as you feel the energetic fingers of the breath massaging the heart, as you sense the connection of breath with this part of the heart, just let Om Aim Hrim Shrim drop with the breath into this region in the center of the chest. And I want to speak a little bit about the way these energies in the heart are personified in the tantras. Someone wrote recently in a Facebook post, actually, that the description of the tantras, the way the tantras described, are not so much descriptive as prescriptive, meaning that they give us a way to focus. They give us literally visual focusing aids for opening up, holding our awareness here so that Kundalini can open it more deeply. But according to the tantras, there's not just one heart center, not just one heart chakra in the subtle body. And this makes sense because this is such a big region. There are actually three. One is the 12-petaled lotus, the Anahata chakra, which is the region that we've been meditating on. And it's called unstruck because when we really tune into the breath moving in the heart, and prana is associated very much with the heart chakra, which is the center of the element of air, that is breath, that there is a subtle sound that the breath makes that resonates in the heart as a sound that actually has no external cause, that is the breath within the breath, has a subtle resonance that's known as nada. And it's that sound is described in the tantric and Vedic text as the sound soham, which we begin to hear in the heart at certain stages of meditation. That's the unstruck sound. But just below the Anahata chakra is a center that's called in some texts the Ananda Kanda, Ananda meaning bliss, Kanda meaning, Kanda is like a pot or a bowl. So it's the pot of bliss. And the reason it's called the pot of bliss is because when we have those experiences of blissfulness centered in the heart, it's said that we're experiencing the Ananda Kanda, which is connected to the Anahata, and which is also sometimes called the spiritual heart. For instance, in Ramana Maharshi's teachings, he speaks about centering yourself in the spiritual heart, which is the Ananda Kanda, just within or just below, depending on either which tantra you're reading or where the energy is situated in you. He would teach his students to bring their awareness into the heart and ask the question, who am I, with awareness in the heart, and allow that question, who am I, meaning who am I really, to kind of drill down past all our ideas and concepts until we begin to experience the true self, which has no name or form or personal history, which is personified as that flame, and which is experienced as, you know, the complete opening or awakening of awareness to its connection to all that is. So the Ananda Kanda is also, of course, the center that the mystics talk about as the seat of the deity or the seat of devotional practice. For instance, the Sufi mystics write so beautifully about the heart, about this aspect of the heart. Mystical Christianity speaks about the sacred heart. And what we notice in all these traditions is that this sacred heart, the spiritual heart, the Ananda Kanda, the inner heart, the heart of the heart, is not on the left side of the body with the physical heart, but it's actually in the center. It's in that place that we are finding with the breath. And there's, according to many tantras, there's a third chamber, let's call it, of the spiritual heart, that's even more esoteric, that in some, it's sometimes called the Hrit Chakra. And that the Hrit Chakra in these texts is said to be actually just inside the physical heart. So it is on the left side, and it's connected by a subtle channel to the crown chakra, the Sahasrara. And many very experienced mystics have said that this Hrit Chakra opens when Kundalini rises to the crown chakra and activates the nectarian experience of radical upper chakra bliss. And it's said that this bliss, this nectar, then trickles down through this subtle channel and ignites or opens the chakra in the physical heart. And according to many people, or to those few people who've written about it, it's when this happens that we really begin to experience permanent full-bodied bliss. So that's something that some of you may have experienced, and which we can all look forward to as Kundalini does her work inside our bodies. And when I say that, I'm not joking. It's something we can all look forward to on this journey. Okay, so the thing about the spiritual heart, the Ananda Kunda, is that it is the place where you install your chosen deity when you're doing that kind of personal deity practice that many traditions teach us. So if you're meditating on Christ in your heart, you know, bringing Jesus into your heart, and you begin to feel this sense of heart connection to deity, this is where you feel it. And of course, in Indian religious practice, there's, and in yogic practice as well, there are very elaborate meditations, very elaborate tantric meditations, where you imagine the deity, the goddess, sitting in the Ananda Kunda in the heart chakra, and you make offerings to her in the heart. And it's, you know, it's a practice that some of you have done with me. It's a very, very beautiful way of connecting to personal deity. But of course, this same center, the spiritual heart, is also a center of emotion, both high spiritual emotions and those other emotions. So when the heart is being purified and opened, there can be such an experience of emotional upheaval, feelings like deep sadness and longing that really feel as though they're coming from somewhere in the core of your being. We've had some conversations on the listserv about longing and the difference between longing and craving or desire. The longing that comes up as the heart is being opened is the longing that's really the longing for God, that, you know, that makes so many of us feel that at a certain point in our practice that nothing in the physical world, nothing in our human relationships can satisfy this longing except the connection with our deep self, with our essence. And when Shakti is moving through the heart, it also happens when Kundalini is moving in the heart, you might find that there is a kind of cycling between certain core emotions. And I believe that this is pretty universal, and the tantras certainly assign particular emotions and feelings to the different lotuses of the heart, which I'm going to mention about, so I'm going to say something about. And there's a couple of the tantric texts that say that in our life as human beings, there's this constant cycling between the petals of the heart, the lotus of the heart. And these are some of the qualities or vrittis that are spoken of. One of the petals of the heart lotus is connected with the feeling of happiness or joy. Another is filled with the desire for romantic communion. So happiness in the first one is more like contentment. The one in the second is a form of, I would call it, romantic infatuation or romantic longing, which I think most of us have experienced at one time or another. Another is hot anger, a very, very strong feeling of hot, heart-based anger, which for some of us, certainly for me these days, when anger comes up, it's sometimes not connected to an incident or even triggered by an incident. It just kind of comes up, and I then get to sit with anger and hold it in my awareness and try to feel where it's made of, what it's made of, and it's usually right there moving around the heart center. Another quality here is the desire to give, you know, this radical feeling of generosity. You know, you sometimes you just want to give to people or want to give your money away or do something incredibly generous. Sometimes I have a friend who really spends a lot of time on this pedal, and when she's in that space, she will give anything to anybody. You know, she's generous, as they say, to a fault. It's very beautiful. Not always to her advantage on the human level, but I would say very much to the advantage of the opening of the heart. Another one is compassion, which we'll say more about later because it's such a beautiful quality in the heart. And there's one that's the tantras call the desire to be a better person, to do good deeds. And then there's one right next to it, which is the pedal of rebelliousness, you know, the you're not the boss of me impulse. And do you notice how when the energy cycles around the heart, all of these things come up and you can't always control them? You know, you can be feeling very full of longing and then all of a sudden you're furious. Or you're going, I don't believe this stuff. I don't believe this teaching. Or, you know, you're just, you know, don't make me do spiritual discipline or anything else. So, and it sometimes it's, you know, it's kind of disconcerting how quickly these energies follow each other. And then there's a pedal in the heart that's sleepy. So some of you who fall asleep in meditation, it's very, very possible that it's just the way the energy is flowing around the heart center. So it's very, and another one of them is the feeling of the experience of renunciation, of detachment, of literally, it sometimes experiences just giving up on the world, like, what do I care? You know, why am I chasing this? Why am I holding on to this? And like the flavors of love, there are many flavors of renunciation, many flavors of detachment. These are some of the experiences that occur as Shakti cycles around the heart chakra. And let's come back to the flame, to the anahata, to the six-petal star, the six-pointed star, the flame within it, and really bring your awareness to the center of the body, just behind the breastbone, and see if you can bring your awareness to the back of the heart. Really bring it backwards, perhaps to a point just in front of your spinal column. And let the breath come in and caress the heart and bring your attention to the flame. Om Aim Prim Shrim. The more you can feel your way into the energy of the syllables, the more the mantra will take root in the heart. And I really love this inner gesture of offering the mantra and offering the breath into the flame. The flame being the signifier of your essence, of what in the West we call the soul. In the Vedic tradition of India, it's said that the essence, the soul, transmigrates from lifetime to lifetime as this flame. So when you leave the body, or when someone leaves the body, what's happening is that this very subtle being, which in Sanskrit is called the Purusha or the Jivatma, that is, Purusha means person and Jivatma means individual self, this individual selfhood of yours, your soul self, leaves the body in the form of this flame, and surrounded, accompanied by the pranas, which again, according to the tradition, carry the soul out the body and into the subtle world, and also accompanied by the so-called karmic backpack, the karmashaya, or the karmic bundle that we carry from lifetime to lifetime. And as I said, as you deepen your meditation, you very well may begin to experience the heart center with a kind of luminosity or a vision, an actual vision of the flame. And this vision, when it happens spontaneously, is almost always accompanied by a sense of wonder as you recognize your own beauty. You know, Rumi says, if you could see your own beauty, you'd be the idol of yourself. You know, in Islam, they don't believe in worshipping idols, unlike us Hindus. And what he says is that the real icon, the real idol, is the flame of the heart, the deepest self. So that's one of the ways in which we sense the heart opening, but it can also be experienced in so many different ways, one of which is a sense of the heart being pierced. And that sense of the heart being pierced can feel very physical. One of my friends describes this, and I've heard it from others, as though an elephant was stepping on your heart. You know, it's this kind of great heaviness in the chest area. Really, it's the result of the prana becoming very thick here. And I always, you know, sometimes people feel like they're having a heart attack. I want to say that if you feel like you're having a heart attack, don't necessarily assume that it's the opening of Kundalini. It's the opening of the heart through Kundalini. But if it happens in meditation, it probably is. Sometimes you feel, you know, kind of electrical energy moving here and there in the heart. And sometimes you feel the heart softening. And very often as the heart begins to open, we become very emotional. This has been my experience over the years, that every time I get a really deep infusion of Shakti, a deeper layer of opening in the heart, I will find myself in tears. I'll find myself just feeling, you know, an enormous sense of emotionality in the heart. And usually these tears are cleansing tears. Sometimes they come with a feeling of enormous love, which, as I said earlier, is actually an aspect of the soul's longing for the beloved, the longing to come home. Ramakrishna, who we've talked about again and again in this class, who was a tremendous lover of God. He was one of the great exponents of bhakti, of the path of devotion. He used to often say that his heart felt as though it were being squeezed like a wet towel, wrung out like a towel, he would say. And I think many of you have had that experience, this deep but subtle pain of longing. You know that there's something that it wants to come. There's something that wants to reveal itself to you. There's a divine experience that is so close, but you can't touch it. And all the devotional traditions, the great devotional traditions, the Sufis, the Bhakti saints of India, the Christian mystics like St. Teresa of Avila, St. John of the Cross, describe this longing. St. Teresa had a famous vision of a spear coming from the Archangel Michael that pierced her heart and opened it. And in the tantras, one of the names for the opening of the chakras is called Veda Mayi, which means piercing. So when Shakti is working strongly in the heart chakra, one of the words, one of the experiences that's described here is the piercing of the knot of the heart, which is called the Vishnu Granti, and which in my experience is not just a metaphor, it's a real thing. That the Vishnu Granti, the knot of Vishnu, Vishnu being the sustainer of the universe, it's said that when the Vishnu Granti is pierced, when on this very subtle level the blocks in the heart open, three things happen. And again, many of you have experienced glimmerings of this, or even, very deep, sustained experiences of this. First of all, your attachment to the stuff that's kept you stuck in family identification, identification with your career issues, essentially the deep human tendency to radical attachment to material life begins to be dissolved, and with it, the sense of being separate from other human beings. So, in other words, the feeling of attachment to your stuff, to your home, to your spouse, to your talents, etc., 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 which, of course, we all have, comes about because we have this deep knot of belief that we are separate and that we are not, I am not you, you are not me. I'm not the cat, I'm not my brother. And therefore, in order to survive, to thrive, I have to hold on to, the stuff that defines me. It's our attachments that are the result of this tendency to differentiate the self from others, and which, of course, has a lot of uses in our individual life, but which has to become gradually lessened in order for the heart to really open. It's said that when an individual liberates herself or himself from the knot of the heart, it doesn't only free us from some of the major attachments that we experience as binding or constricting us, it also frees seven generations of ancestors and seven generations in the future. For those of you who have children, I think that's a very good thing to know. In other words, the piercing of the knot of the heart is actually the freeing of our genetic tendencies, the genetic tendencies of our family lineage, which is, of course, carried in our DNA, and which, since DNA is ancient, it actually frees us up from way back in prehistory. And, we carry these layers and layers of genetic tendencies and attachments that, of course, we're passing down to our children and our children's children, and they literally begin to get cleared with the piercing of the knot of Vishnu. So we'll be saying more about that, and I'd like you to really hold that understanding and look at what's going on in your life with that thought. In my many years of spiritual practice, one of the things that I've seen that's been really very powerful for me personally and for people I know is to realize that the transformation that goes on in us can be seen affecting our family, our children, and also our parents, and the world around us. So one of the ways to look at our spiritual practice and even our work in this life is that each of us is an agent for freeing up the family DNA, the maternal or paternal lineage, not just about your immediate blood family, but really through the whole collective. So let's take a diaphragmatic breath, letting the breath come in, expanding the rib cage through the sides. Gently, gently, letting your attention flow back from the heart, from whatever is going on as you listen to me, back into the heart. Feeling the presence of this six-pointed star radiating in all directions. Feeling perhaps the presence of the flame as a warmth or a luminosity. Recognizing that as you do this simple practice of breath, of heart connection, and of the mantra, you're creating a state of heart coherence, to use the language of contemporary stress work, a physiological state that over time helps you shift from the sympathetic nervous system to the parasympathetic nervous system, opening up the state of relaxation. And as you offer Om Aim Hrim Shrim, pouring the energy of mantra into the flame, feel the radiance softly opening through your chest. And let's talk for a moment, again, with our awareness in the heart about, you know, the elephant in the room, that is the elephant in the heart, which is the interesting paradox that as the heart center is opened, one thing that happens is that we fall in love. We started speaking about this last week in relationship to the second chakra, and we said last week that the second chakra and the fourth chakra are naturally going to start to connect themselves so that our sexual attractions begin to actually help us open the heart and vice versa. So a lot of people, as the heart opens, we start to fall in love. And, you know, normally falling in love feels very, very personal. And this is totally natural, very much related to individual humans or, you know, some other creature. But actually the truth is that as the heart opens, if we can really stay internal with it, what's being awakened is our innate capacity for the love that is not based on need or attachment. And I want to say this not as an invitation for you guys to, to make an effort to love without attachment, which I think all of us have tried to do. Yes, I love this person, but it's okay if, you know, he's with another person or doesn't treat me right, I should be unattached. This isn't that. This is a deep interior recognition of where love comes from, that Kundalini can begin to awaken in you And along the way, there's no question that she may get you to look at some of your attachments. So let's just say that the love that starts to awaken in the heart includes the possibility of recognizing that we carry within ourselves the love that moves the sun and the stars, as Dante says in the Divine Comedy, the love that's the essence of this universe, the love that lives within us as the unshakable presence that is Godness, that is Shakti herself. So most of us, when this starts to happen, aren't necessarily aware that what's being awakened in us is divine love. So what sometimes happens is, and it's a big part of the sadhana of the heart, is that a kind of replay of one form or another of romantic love. And I want to define romantic love, and I'm not dissing it in any way. It's my favorite thing. But I want to define romantic love not as just the love between you and a lover, or you and a girlfriend or boyfriend or spouse or partner, but it's actually it's a particular quality of affection, a particularly juicy flavor that Jung called eros, romantic eros. That's, you know, the in loveness quality that makes your encounters with another person so interesting and juicy, and, you know, that draws you to them. So there's a kind of a heart pull. That so romantic love, in the sense that I'm speaking of it, contains a kind of pull and joy in another person's presence. And as you know, it can happen in families, and many families there's a romantic flavor to the relationship between a parent and one or another of the children, which is sometimes difficult for the other kids. I know my mother, in my family, my mother was completely in love with my oldest brother. He was the love of her life, one might say, and God bless her. So nice she had that relationship, but, you know, it was a little not so fun for some of her other kids, but very, very real. And it also sometimes happens with a teacher. And when it happens with a teacher, it can be incredibly important, because it's that love for the teacher that lets you kind of follow the teacher's path and take it seriously. But part of what begins to occur and what we begin to realize is that when we fall in love with somebody, whether it's someone we're dating, or a sibling, or a child, or our teacher, what Kundalini is wanting to show us at this particular point in life as we're awakening is really that the person you fall in love with when your heart center opens is a stand-in, a symbol, a form that allows you to experience or to begin to recognize the inner beloved, the God in your heart. So I want to say it again, and this is one of the deepest truths that my sadhana has shown me, and believe me, I came to this kicking and screaming, because the desire to make another person the center of our life, in my case it was a teacher for a long time, but that desire is so primal and so human. We sometimes have to, you know, really be taken by the scruff of the neck and turn back inside to get it. And I also want to say that when you come to realize that it's the inner beloved that you're looking for, it doesn't mean that it wrecks your relationship with outer beloveds, not at all. In fact, it may deepen it, because it begins to lessen the feeling of attachment and neediness that's around so many of our relationships. So in the silence of the heart, in the pull of the heart to the inner beloved, it can sometimes actually be helpful when the elder beloved is someone that you are not going to have a normal love affair with. It's and sometimes it is, but you may have the karma to be very close to someone that you fall in love with, and you may not, but it actually doesn't matter. Sometimes the person your heart opens to is someone who's not in love with you, or who has a different sexual orientation than yours, or who lives far away, or who's married to someone else, or is, you know, is a 10-year-old when you're a 35-year-old. And sometimes if you're fortunate enough to have one of the great romantic teacher-student relationships like Rumi had with his teacher Shams of Tabriz, you know, this passionate love affair with a teacher who can be the model of freedom, the model of liberation, you know, then it's very obvious that the love affair is intended to take you towards the heart. And even though the great guru disciple stories can be misleading for those of us who don't have that karma, nonetheless, these stories are so beautiful. And I recently became kind of tuned in to this love story of St. Francis and his great female disciple, St. Clare, when I was in Assisi a couple of years ago. Some of you may know this story, which in the tradition is not usually painted as a romance, but it clearly was, even though probably not consummated in the physical way. But so Clare was the child of a wealthy family in Florence. She was very religious and, you know, drawn to God. And she met St. Francis and was awakened to love almost immediately. I mean, she fell in love with him. But St. Francis was a monk, and he was a saint and a famous renunciant. And she seems to have been aware that what she was falling in love with was not so much him per se as his passion for God. So she ran away from her family and kind of burst into this chapel where he was living with his brother friars. This was in the early days of the Franciscan order, and told him that she wanted to stay there forever. And Francis, who was, you know, you have to remember, part of a really radically celibate order and only hung out with men and animals, recognized her longing, and so he sheltered her. He refused to allow her to return to her family. Eventually, a bunch of her friends, her girlfriends, came to stay with her, and she founded an order of nuns called the Poor Clares. And if you've ever been to Assisi and been to the Basilica of St. Clare, you know how much unbelievably powerful love energy she generated, and that people have generated in her subtle presence ever since. And she really stands in the Christian mystical tradition in a very apparent way. You know, the Jesus Mary Magdalene stories are hard to find documentation for, though they may well be true. But Francis and Clare were the real deal. Clare was the last person who saw him at his death. And when I talk about her, I always start to cry, which is one of the signs that, you know, there's a Shakti in her that can touch the heart, open the heart. But what Clare seems to realize, and what those of us who fall in love with the teacher usually realize, is that the love isn't about the teacher. It's the opening of divine love. And in the traditions, especially in the Sufi tradition, the divine beloved is often described in poetry as having a form, you know, and having the form of a beautiful young boy who, of course, beautiful young boys were major love objects in the Arab world, or in the form of a beautiful woman. And in the Hindu Bhakti tradition, in the Vaishnava, the tradition of the forms of the divine called Vishnu and Krishna and Rama, when the divine masculine is seen as Krishna, or as Rama, his consort, his Shakti, manifests in the form of a woman, of a consort, who is called Radha or Lakshmi or Sita. And I want to say something about Radha, who in the devotional tradition, of course, is considered to be really the holy god, the holy guide to bhakti, to devotional love, to the quality of love that arises in the heart when the heart is kindled or pierced. And as I think many of you know her story, she was Krishna's lover. They were 14 years old. They were teenage lovers. And in the poetic tales of the Vaishnava tradition, it's said that she was married. So that means that her devotion for Krishna was really dangerous in a traditional society. In other words, she risked her life by being in love with Krishna. And at one point in the story, Krishna, who is actually a prince, has to leave the little town where Radha and his friends live, where he's been brought up, and go to the city to take up his role, slay a few demons, and become an adult. So he leaves Radha behind and never sees her again. It's very, very sad, and it's said that Radha and all her friends are so much in love with Krishna, they have so much longing for Krishna, that they begin to see Krishna in everything, in the trees, in the cows, in each other. So this very personal devotional love is transformed into self-realization just through the power of longing. You can let the breath flow in and out of the heart. Let the mantra flow in and out of the heart. Feel that the breath, as we said in the beginning, is the god, is the goddess, is the lover who's knocking on the door of the heart, who wants to experience the opening of your heart, who wants to show you what's inside your heart. We're going to do a meditation on the inner beloved. Some of you have done this with me before, and I really want to give us time to do it, to begin to recognize that in every one of us, there is a deeply personal, deeply subtle fountain of love, which for many of us is experienced as the beloved. In the Indian tradition, the inner beloved is considered to be the deity, as we've said earlier. And one of the forms in which the inner deity is experienced in Tantra, or is described in Tantra, is as a form of the goddess Lalita, who is a personal form of Kundalini. And it's said that when Kundalini awakens in the Muladhara, in the base of the spine, she awakens as a child. She's known as Bala Kundalini. And As she matures and grows up, she rises to the heart where she is known as Shodashi, which means the 16-year-old. She grows up into a teenage girl in traditional India. 16 is considered the age of true sexual maturity for a woman. And as Shodashi, as Lalita in the heart, she begins to long for her lover, who is Shiva. And she actually creates her lover inside the heart, which is, you know, I think a beautiful metaphor for the way in which in our longing we bring forth the experience of the inner beloved. And the divine masculine, the form of Shiva, Lalita's consort in the heart, is known as Kameshwara, that is the Lord of desire, the Lord of intense bliss. So the beginning of the recognition that your Shakti is longing for the experience of the beloved in the heart is also the beginning of the manifestation of that being, which may not take any kind of physical expression at all. It's not like you have to see a god or a goddess or Jesus or the Divine Mother or Krishna. But it does mean that you're getting to the point where your lower, so to speak, your instinctual longings are ready to expand and take you into the experience of the inner love. And when we do this practice of calling on the inner beloved, we sometimes find that the beloved appears in forms that are strange to us. You know, they may be beautiful, they may be not so beautiful, they may be the form of an animal or of your grandmother, or maybe no form at all. One woman, when she did this meditation in one of my classes, we were imagining the presence of the beloved in the heart. What came up for her was the image of a toad. And she told this story, and I thought of the frog prince, you know, the toad who turned into a prince. But she said that when she first saw this toad as a vision in her heart, she was kind of embarrassed and sort of shocked and thought there was, you know, something weird happening. And the toad reached out its arm and handed her an enormous diamond. And as she took the diamond, she realized that what she was receiving was the many-faceted light of the self, which the beloved in this form, I mean, we could say that maybe the toad represented the disguises in which love takes, or the ideas that we might have about, you know, love showing up in unexpected forms. But the beloved was doing what the beloved does, which is to show you the beauty of the inner world, the beauty of yourself. And as she looked at this toad, it started to transform itself into many, many different people, people she'd known in her life, people she'd never seen, and then it just kind of dissolved into a feeling of energy. So I'm telling you this story so you you just open yourself to whatever arises. Whatever it is, remember, our aim in this unfolding, in this awakening, is to be present with what is. So, you might want to stretch for a second, and then find yourself a posture where your back can be upright. It's actually fine to do this meditation lying in Shavasana. It actually works very well as a form of yoga nidra that you can do in a lying down position. So you can begin by once more becoming present to the heart, becoming present with the breath in the heart, and then allowing the breath to flow in and out through the whole center of the chest in a very easy and relaxed way. And we're just going to start by letting the breath drop the mantra into the heart. Om Aim Hrim Shrim. And you might take a moment to place in your heart, along with the mantra, the intention or the wish or the longing to deepen your experience of the inner beloved. Remembering that this is an intention, not an expectation. Now from the heart, feel yourself standing in a place, in a sacred place, which feels very beautiful and very safe. And from this place, imagine that you begin to walk very slowly. Walking down a path. Walking to a secret place, which is really the depth of the heart space where the beloved lives. And you may experience this place as a garden, as a crystal cave, as a temple. Just find the place and know that what you're doing here is entering more and more deeply into the inner chamber, the inner room, the inner garden of the heart. Perhaps there's no visual at all. Perhaps there's just a feeling. Perhaps you're sitting in what we might call the unknown, the fertile darkness, which is also one of the great centers in the heart. Feel the breath deepening and becoming softer. Feel that you're comfortably seated here and that you're in a place of profound safety, profound holding. And from this place, within this place, ask your inner beloved, the being of your inmost beloved, the beloved of the heart, the beloved form, the divine presence who has loved you since the beginning of time and who is also you yourself. The one who sees you and knows you in all your beauty, in all your woundedness, and utterly and completely adores you, who is never apart from you, who is never not holding you. Who may take one form or many forms or no form. And as you ask the Beloved to be present with you, just be open to who or what appears, not expecting the Beloved to have a particular form, but recognizing that the Beloved is real, is there. Allowing yourself to settle into the feeling of the presence of your Divine Beloved, your inner companion, your guide, your mother, father, teacher, your lover. Who may have a form or no form. Just let yourself sit and breathe with the presence of the inner lover, the inner beloved. How does the beloved feel? Does the Beloved have a voice, a color or texture? And you can ask the Beloved if there is anything he or she or it has to show you or say to you, to make present for you, to infuse into you. Recognize that the communication may come as a feeling, as an image, as words. And feel, if you can, the way the Beloved holds you, embraces you, invites you. And if you feel like hesitant or unsure, just offer that feeling or whatever other feeling comes up. And then just sitting in the heart with the breath flowing. See if you can relax into the felt sense of being present with the Beloved in the heart. with your awareness still flowing inside the heart, allow yourself to become more present with the flow of the breath. In just a moment, we're going to invite questions, so I'm giving you warning that this is going to happen. But I also want to give you a moment or two to just really be present in your body and recollect, and even if you want to or if it feels right, write down what arose in that meditation. This is a practice that may feel radically real to you in this moment, or may take some practice to allow to unfold. But I want to assure you that the beloved in the heart is not only real, but belongs to you, is both part of yourself and yet is a divine other, a divine beloved lover, mother, father, brother, sister, friend, goddess, God, teacher, Kundalini herself. As you, but also with you. And for those of you who have a question that you'd like to ask, this is a good moment to press star 7 on your keyboard, on your phone, I'm sorry. And if you'd like to ask a question, you can do so. Star 7. And in the meantime, we'll just allow ourselves to sit in the energy of the heart.
On your phone, I'm sorry.
Hi.
Hi.
Who is this?
Hello.
Hello, we're here. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Sally.
How are you doing?
I have you on the other computer, and there's a slight delay in the computer. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
Wonderful meditation and class. I admit that I have a phenomenal app on my computer that turns all of your voice into essentially Shakti in the form of a peacock feather that just touches my hair and everything goes, well, you know what happens then. Everything gets...
That's a great app.
Yeah, it is. And yeah, I built it myself. It works really well, especially with your voice. That would be the... That's what it's tuned to, I believe, and that's why everybody else is on the call, I'm sure. My use of the chakras is certainly in going deep and expanding and having the wonderful non-dual just awareness and all the fun that and beauty that holds. And I've also used some chakra meditations to be grounding, and to be what works for me is a concept where the I learned something years ago where I say 4 different words at each chakra, and what that does is it gives the idea that the words are useful in the non kundalini part of life.
Right.
You know, when Tammy Simon, who seems like a wonderful facilitator of everything, comes on with these, like the last series of interviews she did, she asks every speaker, you know, this non-dual stuff that you're into, this deeper space, can you tell me that you're there all the time? Okay, I challenge you. And
right.
My question is, why would anybody want to be there all the time? You know, it's fun to have bubbles in your nose when champagne hits, but you don't need to be so blasted with you're laying in your cave for, you know, I mean, I think that's wonderful. I have done that. It is the best thing in the world. And we all have the balance thing that we do where since people don't come and feed us, we show back up and do the household tasks.
Right, so, right on.
So, you know, for example, in some of these words that I learned, and I think it was originally written in Sanskrit, but somebody named Deepak somebody or other, some guy with some rhinestone on his glasses, gave one of those 7-day talks one time, and he said, this is secret. He said, this is like from the sitters. You want really power?
Right,
then
right.
You do this. And, of course,
right.
Everything in India is sold that way. If you do 10,000 of these, this will happen. But,
right.
For example, in the heart, the words are peace. And, you know, I imagine the heart, and then I actually made a tape of it. You know, established in nonviolence is the phrase, and then you say
right.
peace over the next minute. As
right.
the mantra, and breathe in and out with the word peace, and the next word is established in the cosmic dance, harmony. And
right.
I have been in business deals and things, and I'll go in there and people, rah, 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 and I'll think, peace, harmony. Let's see, you're
right.
singing a G, and if I sang, I don't want to sing F sharp.
Can I interrupt?
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No,
don't be sorry. Don't be sorry.
I'm sorry.
It's beautiful. And I do know this meditation. I think the other one is love and laughter, right? Is that correct?
Right.
Yeah, and I think it's a beautiful meditation. And thank you for offering it. Yes, it's totally true that especially in the heart, these, you know, working with words and images in daily life can really, really help kind of coordinate your inner life with your functional life. And, you know, you're totally right. Harmony during a business meeting is with awareness of the heart is really, really helpful. So thank you so much for actually giving us that secret. And
I wanted to play because mostly when I listen to you, I go into the other side of it where everything is just open and blissful, and I forget if I have a body or where I am. So,
yeah, so it's good to have something
to
connect you in a body. So why don't you
please.
Send these words?
I will.
And it's a beautiful practice, and thank you so much for your imaginative and mellow sharing.
Thank you.
I want to move on because there's another question.
Yes, of course.
And
I'm sorry. I get carried away.
No, don't be sorry. We love you. So
love you too. Thank you. Love everybody.
So this is from Padma on the web. She said, a few days ago while meditating in the second chakra, I felt something sweet in me. After a second, my mind came in and started to compare it with other sweet things, and then inevitably it was gone. And I know this is one of the most frustrating things about the experiences that arise in meditation is that inevitably the mind comes in and goes, oh, this is interesting, or this is weird, or, oh, this is like an experience I had once, and I wonder what it means. And in its role as as one translator of the Upanishad said, in the role, what the mind does is condense the expanded consciousness and essentially kill the experience. So there's an art that we come to learn in meditation, and it takes a little while for most of us, which is to kind of sequester the mind such that when this stuff comes up, which it inevitably will, because it's one of the things the mind does, it's like its job, so to speak, is, as you know, in another form of what Bob was talking about, bringing us back to earth. So you can actually learn to hear that voice of comparison or fear or excitement or whatever it is and just note it, or say, okay, Shakti, and let the subtle experience be what it is. You know, most subtle experiences will eventually evanesce. And trying to hold on to them usually doesn't work for too long. But you can actually train yourself to not take the extra step of following the mind as it compares and contrasts and, you know, gets curious. Just remember that there's always time after meditation to contemplate what the experience means. So thank you for that, Padma. I know exactly what you're talking about, and I'm sure so does everyone else. So big breath in and let it flow through the heart. Does anyone else have a question?
Sally, this is Gail.
Hi, Gail.
Hi. I had two questions. I was wondering if there's, to speak a little bit about, if there's anything about an infinity sign that I see sometimes in the chakras or coming up through my body. And
well, what I would say is that infinity sign is actually a visual depiction of, you know, what we, somebody shared on the listserv, Mary, actually, about a dream she had in which she was shown by a goddess, a sort of an earth goddess, the way the cycles of seasons and the cycles of life spiral around each other is like a snake biting its tail. And that infinity sign is one of the symbolic images that many people see of that sort of the way in which reality is a kind of endless loop. You know, whether we call it samsara or, you know, or the quality of endlessness, you know, of infinity, it's the circle. You know, it's the infinite loop, it's the Mobius strip, it's a symbol of the mystery. So it's a profound image, and I would say, giving my, you know, in an interpretive mode, that when you see one of that image in your chakras, you might consider that it's telling you that this part of your being, this subtle spaciousness inside your body, inside your sushumna nadi, actually does contain the infinite. As William Blake said, you know, to see the world in a grain of sand, infinity in an hour, that deep truth is residing in every one of our chakras. You know, our chakras are not a hierarchy of this is a lower chakra, this is an upper chakra, this is a good chakra, this is a bad chakra. Each one of them is a doorway to the infinite. So it's a very cool.
My other question kind of rides on that, in that I've been wondering a lot lately about how, you know, when she was talking about her dream and you responded and all, and if you could elaborate a little bit more about what the more feminine aspect of it, the, I think you call it the Shakta aspect of it, would be in the world. You know, the Shiva I get kind of because that's the study that we all do, but the Shakta seems to be a little different in how do we look at the world from that perspective.
Beautiful question, and because we have a limited time, I'm going to try and hold some of it over till next week. The Shakti and the Shakta viewpoint is the mystery of how the embodied world is goddess, is sacred. And, you know, in the earth religions, which is kind of what Mary's dream was about, and a lot of us hold in our DNA the ancient earth religions of goddess, which were related to the moon, to the cycles of the moon, to the menstrual cycles, to the tides, to the seasons, to the way in which reality is constantly returning to the starting place, and in which we come to understand and not understand. It's because it's not really an intellectual understanding. In my experience, it's a recognition. It's a visceral recognition that your body is completely connected to the earth, to all the other bodies, to the planet itself, to the universe, to each other. And that is the Shakta path. It's the path of total interconnectedness, as well as the recognition that the embodied world is sacred. You know, that thing that Bob was talking about of, you know, how we don't want to just be in the great spaciousness. We also want to be moving in the world. The goddess path, the Shakta path, is different from what is, you know, traditionally in the Indian tradition called the Shiva path, which is really the path that sees the ultimate reality as being pure consciousness, disembodied, that is, free of matter. The Shakta path is all about the reality of matter as sacred as well, and it's the tantric traditions are at their heart all about showing us how to find the sacred in our embodiment, in our embeddedness in matter, and to be free in our Shivaness, in the freedom of pure awareness, and also to dance in the world as through the cycles of life, you know, which are often repetitive, apparently boring, sometimes painful, but which are utterly imbued with goddess. So I hope that's enough of an answer to start with. I will talk about it a little bit next week. It's a truly exquisite realization, and you know, it's been for me the realization that has allowed me to, you know, live in the world in a kind of ecstasy, you know, because she shows me, and she shows each of us, that she is all this. So thank you for the question.
Thank you very much.
So, my dear ones, we are at the end of our time, and I want to respect your schedules. So we're going to bring our class to an end. You'll be getting homework tomorrow, and as well as Bob's four words for the heart, which I think is going to be a great walking around practice for a lot of us. And a few other things, including a contemplation on forgiveness that I want to really invite you to play with. So as we bring our class to a close, and I do want to invite you to journal a little bit about what happened tonight, whatever it was. Let's just bring our awareness to the breath, to the space of the heart, to that star, that six-pointed star, which may simply be experienced as the expansive quality of energy in the heart, and to the sense of this subtle flame, which is both the flame of awareness and the flame of our individuality, both our individual or local consciousness and also the doorway into the recognition that that consciousness is everywhere. Just let the breath flow with Om, Aim, Hrim, Shrim. Letting the breath bow to the heart, offer the mantra into the heart. Om, Aim, Hrim, Shrim. Peace, harmony, love, laughter. Om for peace. Aim for, in this moment, harmony. Harim for love. Shreem for laughter. Shreem is the mantra of the utter delicious auspiciousness of everything. It's the mantra of Goddess Lakshmi, who's the heart of the enjoyment of the world. And we'll just sit for a moment or two in that space. Recognizing the presence of our shared consciousness, the subtle vortex of our connection to each other through this sangham, knowing that whenever you tune into this broadcast, this speaking, you're here inside the sangham. Have a beautiful day, evening, week, and just know that from the heart you are so loved. Namaste. See you soon.